For unto thee will I give this land.
Our brother John Martin. My beloved brothers and sisters and our dear young people, well, it was from the excellency and the beauty of the Chaldeans that the God of a greater glory, as Stephen says, brought our father Abraham. When he dwelt, brothers and sisters, and sat down, as the Hebrew says, at Haran and delayed there, it was Stephen again who says that God took him captive and impelled him towards the promised land, and into that land he came. We will always remember, will we not, the first stop there between Ebal and Gerizim at Shechem, the great place of eternal decisions, when Abraham had the choice, as our brother Peter has intimated, between separation and assimilation, for the Canaanite was then in the land. And that solitary monument of the oak of which was there, brothers and sisters, at that place, the oak of Moreh, the solitary monument of Moreh, which means a teacher or an archer or the first rains, all saying one and the same thing, pointing the way. The archer with his arrow, the teacher with his lesson, and the first rain with the seasons, telling what is to come and telling Abraham that best is the way, separate yourself from the people of this land. And he passed through that land and came to Bethel. And he learned at Bethel another principle, brethren and sisters. And for the first time in the record of Abraham's life, though we know that he must have dwelt in tents, we are not told until we get here to Bethel, at the house of God. And the Apostle Paul, we learned, did we not, last evening, picked that up in Hebrews 11 and said that he dwelt in tabernacles or tents with the heirs of the promise, Isaac and Jacob, for he sought a city whose builder and maker is God. And he learned there the principle, brethren and sisters, of pilgrimage. And he commemorated that with a wonderful order at that place. And still he journeyed on further and came to the Negev, did he not? To the south, to the dry country. And there was a famine in the land. And it would appear, brethren and sisters, that at the outset of Abraham's journey of faith, Yahweh was to test him all the way. Faith can only be purified by trial. And Abraham was already enduring, we believe, tremendous trials. If they were not physical persecutions, brethren and sisters, they were certainly hammering away at his mind. Unto thy seed will I give this land. He's got no seed. His wife is barren. Unto thy seed will I give this land. The land is swarming with Canaanites. Unto thy seed will I give this land. And the land is absolutely famished. And there's every circumstance of life that swirled about him spoke of the impossibility of that promise being fulfilled. And in the extremity of that moment, in the Negev country, the dry country, he hit upon the expedient that he would go to Egypt, not to stop, but to sojourn there as a stranger, feeling that he might have a respite, brothers and sisters, from the storms of life. But no good came out of Egypt. And he left Egypt, a greatly humiliated man, the father of many nations, having to suffer a rebuke on moral issues from a Gentile king. And the record said, did it not, that Pharaoh sent him away and all that he had. And what he got out of Egypt, brothers and sisters, was to prove disastrous in his life. For he brought out of Egypt riches, cattle and goods, which became a source of contention between him and his brother, his nephew Lot, who of course was his brother in the faith. And he brought out of Egypt the handmaidens that Pharaoh had given him, one of whom, Hagar the Egyptian, was to prove, brethren and sisters, a tremendous thorn in the flesh for that married couple. No good ever comes out of going into Egypt. And in chapter 10 and verse 12, we read that he went down into Egypt. Chapter 12, rather, and in verse 10, he went down into Egypt. And in chapter 13 and verse 1, we read that Abraham went up out of Egypt, brothers and sisters. And in those two geographical settings, going down and going up, we have the story of Abraham recovering from that trial, brethren and sisters. And though he may have gone on and made other mistakes, and though he may have gone on again and denied his wife, he never went down into Egypt. He learnt that lesson. And years went by, brethren and sisters, and his seed never learnt that lesson. And if they had walked in the steps of that faith of their father Abraham, they would have never wanted to go back to Egypt. And it was, as it were, as if in this story of Abraham, that God is setting the mould or the pattern of every son and daughter of faith. You never go to Egypt. It may appear to be a place of respite, a never-ending supply of the good things of this life. No need of rain. It all comes down from the hinterland of Africa and spreads itself out into a land of plenty. But it never does you any good, brethren and sisters. And as we learn from Zechariah 14, in the age to come, when the Lord Jesus Christ will be in the earth with all the saints, that Zechariah 14 brings together, that never again will Egypt ever become a curse upon the people of God, and never again will there be a Canaanite in the house of Yahweh. And Abraham was to learn those lessons sorely, but learnt them, brethren and sisters, he did. And that's the greatness of our father Abraham. Now, when you read chapter 13, you cannot miss the lesson of those early verses. Look, in the third verse of chapter 13, and it says, he went on his journeys. He went on his journeys. That doesn't mean to say, brothers and sisters, that Abraham set out just to go for a little walk somewhere. Because in the Hebrew it says, he went through his stations. And when you read that chapter, you can't help but being impressed that Abraham is hurrying back to the place of Bethel. He wanted to get back where he made that mistake between Bethel and Ai, between the house of God and ruin, and he wanted to put that matter right. He never wanted to do that again. And going back between the house of God and ruin, he hurried back through each station. And you read the station. He went up out of Egypt. End of verse 1. He went into the south. He came from the south, even to Bethel. He came to that place where his tent had been, between Bethel and Ai, under the altar, station by station by station. He's deliberately retracing his steps. And that record in Genesis is brilliantly written, telling us that. And he got back there, reconstructed that altar, and I believe a very determined and a very chastened and a very humble man determined that never again would he make that mistake. And men, brothers and sisters, who learn that lesson in their lives by bitter experience ought to retrace their steps station by station by station and get back where they started. And to resolve in their heart and mind that never again will they make those mistakes. And so he went on his journeys, deliberately retracing those steps. 180-odd mile he went, brothers and sisters, until he came even to Bethel, to the house of God, where his tent had been at the beginning. What an eloquent phrase that is. With all the permanence of Egypt, with its never-ending supplies of the commodities of this life, but he gets back to where his tent had been at the beginning. Back to a life of pilgrimage, brothers and sisters. A little bit harder, perhaps, but a lot more satisfying. And back he came, fortified to stand between Bethel and Ai, and able now to say to another man, you make the decision. You say whatever you like, I'll leave it to you. And standing there knowing exactly the principles, he had no fear, brothers and sisters, now that God would determine a course for him, which would not end in a disaster as that one did, but would end with him ultimately standing in that land, the possessor of all of it. Fortified he was now to do that. And he went back to relive that moment of worship. And it says that he came there, he made that altar, and he called on the name of Yahweh.
as he did before.
Exactly that.
At the end of verse 8 of chapter 12, he built an altar unto Yahweh and he called upon the name of Yahweh. And now he's home again, back to where he started. And you can just imagine that prayer, brothers and sisters, as he knelt beside that altar of unhewn stone where God recorded his name. And we can only surmise what he would have said and how he would have thought. But I don't think we'd be very far from the mark as we would see a man very humble indeed, humbled by a bitter experience, suffering a stinging rebuke from people outside the truth on moral issues, and having to come back and bow before his God and saying, I should have never left this place, back to where his tent was at the beginning. Now verse 5 of chapter 13 tells us, and Lot also, which went with Abraham, that he had flocks and herds and tents. You know, brothers and sisters, we do an injustice to Lot to criticize him too muchly. As Peter said, he was a righteous and a just man. He tortured his soul in Sodom. He was a faithful man. He stuck with Abraham. He went to Egypt with him and he came out of Egypt with him. But he never forgot Egypt. It came into his mind, brothers and sisters, at a very, very inopportune time. I'll show you that in a minute. He never forgot it. You know, we have people say, oh, it's good for our children to taste of the world. Rubbish. It's like telling your child to have a drink of poison to see that it doesn't work on you. Some children, brothers and sisters, some grown-up people who have those experiences never forget them. There are indelible impressions made. And an indelible impression was made upon the mind of Lot. And that indelible impression, brothers and sisters, led that man into tragic circumstances. And now the very riches, the very prosperity which they had acquired in Egypt, as well in the land, became, brothers and sisters, a matter of adversity between them. Isn't it terrible? An uncle and a nephew who before this time dwelt together through the difficulties of life in the famine, stuck through thick and thin, went down to Egypt together and came out of Egypt together, are divided by prosperity. Prosperity divided them. There's a lesson in that, brethren and sisters. And even that prosperity that divided was in itself a blessing from God. And many men have gone the way of all flesh, taken away with the blessings from God which they have misused. Blessings which they ought to see, brothers and sisters, are things for to be thankful about, to use them wisely and well in the service of God, knowing that the earth is Yahweh's and the fullness thereof. But not all people think like that. And now we come to a time of a test, and we're told here that the land in verse 6 was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together. The land was not able to bear them. The promised land. See, we don't understand, do we? If you were to uproot your home and travel on foot for hundreds of miles through difficult circumstances with a large retinue of servants and relatives through a difficult terrain, and you were to come into a promised land and find that it couldn't support two families and the place is swarming with other people, what would you think? You'd think, well, first of all, this is a good state of affairs, this is. In the present circumstances, the land can't bear me and my nephew. This is what you could have thought. And secondly, how could it ever do it? Because we learn that the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt in the land. And those two races of people, brothers and sisters, were noted for their large herds and flocks. Abraham and Lot were not the only sharers of that land. And this is the promised land. And so they found difficulties. And in verse 7, there was a strife. Oh yes. That strife, brethren and sisters, commenced between the herdmen of Lot and Abraham. It's to their credit that strife didn't originate within the men themselves. Abraham and Lot did not initially lock horns over who was to go where in that land. It was the herdsman that did that first. But Abraham was a wise man, brothers and sisters, and he saw that it would be inevitable that strife would come down to personalities in the end. He knew that. And that strife was the beginning of the end for Lot. It doesn't pay, brothers and sisters, to have trouble with Abraham. I'm not suggesting at all that this, what I'm going to say now, applies in its fullness to Lot, because it doesn't. But there's a sense, brothers and sisters, that it does apply to him. When God said, I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse him that curseth thee. I reiterate, that did not apply to Lot, that latter expression. But nonetheless, they are blessed who are blessed with faithful Abraham. And he left faithful Abraham. And whilst people, I will bless them, plural, that bless thee, I will curse him, singular, that curseth thee. None will escape the consequences and separate from Abraham, not even Lot. And Lot, brothers and sisters, got into trouble, didn't he? And strife was the beginning of the end for him, and it caused that separation between him and Abraham. And we are blessed with faithful Abraham, says the apostle. We're not blessed without him. And look where that led Lot. Lot was a very rich man, so the record tells us. And we know, brethren and sisters, what riches can do. We see riches like the Nile Delta that the bank presents to us, a never-ending supply of the commodities of this world so that we can have confidence in our future and the future of our families. And we build our confidence upon that basis. And there's not a brother or a sister, however they might express themselves eloquently concerning the faith, is without some concern about that security that never-ending supply of monetary value can do for us. But the Apostle Paul pointed out that when that becomes a dominant feature in our lives, brothers and sisters, we err from the faith and pierce ourselves through with many sorrows. Did that happen to Lot? He lost his home, then his wife. His daughters had married outside the truth. And even when they left with him, brothers and sisters, in a horrendous circumstance, they committed incest with their own father. And it didn't end there. God forgives Lot, brothers and sisters, and he's in God's kingdom. But forgiveness does not mean that we escape the consequences of our foolishness. Forgiveness means that God will give us his grace and will not hold that against us for eternity, and we'll be in his kingdom and it'll all be forgotten. But we will never escape the consequences of our folly. Didn't end there. As a result of that incestuous union, there were two boys born called Moab and Ammon. Both names meaning, having a connotation meaning from father. Those two boys came into great nations, brothers and sisters, listed in Psalm 83 in a gallery of Israel haters called the children of Lot. Listed among all the haters of Israel, the children of Lot. Look at the consequences of that folly. And when Zephaniah the prophet lined up all the nations for condemnation, Gaza and Ashkelon, Tyre and all the other nations surrounding Israel, when he came to Edom and Moab, he said this. He warned those two nations that they should be extremely careful about their attitude to Israel, because he said, I will make you like Sodom and Gomorrah. And if ever There were two nations on the face of God's earth that should have known what that meant. They should have, because they were conceived, brethren and sisters, under the shadow of that Holocaust. Those nations should never have missed the point of that. And so the consequences of separation from Abraham are enormous. And that's why in this chapter, brethren and sisters, it ends up with the emphasis upon walking with him. That's why it ends up like that. As if God is giving us a cameo of our own personal lives. So then they that be of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham. But none will escape who depart from the course of that faith. I will curse him, singular, but curseth thee. None will escape. Lot escaped, brothers and sisters, ultimately. But what a dreadful price he had to pay. You know, it was Abraham who made the decision, the suggestion about separation. We learn, for example, at the end of the seventh verse, that the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt then in the land. We'd learnt previously that the Canaanite dwelt in the land. Other tribes were coming in, brothers and sisters. It was getting crowded. And you know, if ever there was a time when brethren should have stuck together, it's now. Nonetheless, Abraham could see, wise man that he now was, that it was better, brothers and sisters, to separate than to fight. Later on, we're going to learn that God held Lot responsible for that separation, not Abraham. He didn't hold Abraham responsible for it, yet Abraham suggested it. And you see, in Abraham's suggestion, brethren and sisters, there was not a suggestion that there should be a division. That's an appalling thought. But he knew that if they wouldn't separate, it would become worse than division. It would break out into open war between brethren. And he says, we're brethren. We didn't ought to do that. We be brethren, he said, at the end of verse 8. And brethren, we're told in the psalm, ought to dwell together in unity. And then, brothers and sisters, we have one of the most remarkable demonstrations of faith possible. As he gave Lot the widest and the first choice, is not the whole land before me? You know, it does us well, brethren and sisters, and I mean this sincerely. I think we are foolish Christadelphians if we don't take the opportunity from time to time to sit down. And without going into all the details of the Word of God, with all the Hebrew and the Greek manuscripts, to sit down and consider exactly what that would have meant to Abraham. As he stood there, and he's got an enormous responsibility. He loved his wife with a love that defies explanation, as we learn from the record of the prophets. He had a great responsibility towards her. He had a lot of servants, 318 at least of them. He had herds and flocks. He was a man who accepted his responsibilities. And he stood there and said to Lot, you can take what you like. You think of that, brothers and sisters. You watch people in life. You watch people in the little things in life. Watch them in the home. At work, in the office. Out on the work floor. Anywhere. And see who does that. See who's first up to do the menial tasks. See who it is who stands at the back when everything else is to be taken by others. See who it is that says to the others, you go first. Do what you like. And I'll take what's ever left. Who does that? And we don't do that, brethren and sisters, in the tiny things in life. This man did it with the absolute basic necessities of existence. I don't think we can overemphasize the tremendous act of faith which Yahweh in the heavens must have been extremely pleased with, to hear Abraham say that. And it wasn't, brethren and sisters, just being plainly magnanimous. It wasn't that he was just kind. He'd learnt because he knew, under thy seed
will I give this land.
That's what we call
faith.
That's what it is. He took God at his word, brethren and sisters. Do you know what Paul called him? He's got a lot of titles, Abraham. We've gone through a few of them. The friend of God, the Hebrew, the father of the faithful. But Paul coined another title for him. In the 7th chapter of Hebrews, he called him in the Greek, the holder of the promises. The holder of the promises. And here's the holder of the promises saying, take what you like. And that holder of the promises was saying, unto thy seed will I give this land. That's what we call faith. And those sort of things, brothers and sisters, ought to generate in us, as we call him the father of our faith, we ought to generate, to gender within us, the same spirit of faith in all avenues of life. Concerning this world, you go first. Have what you want. And believe in God. That's the essence of life, brothers and sisters. Well, it was too much for Lot. He probably never stopped to think, brothers and sisters, that A, Abraham was the whole of the promises, and B, he was his senior, he was his uncle, and C, he was, of course, his spiritual head. Probably never stopped to think about that. And I believe in a moment when he was veiled, as his name really means, Lot means veiled, in a veiled moment he forgot those principles. He should have turned around and said to Abraham, oh, no way will I do that. Goodness me, look, God's promised the land to you, you're my uncle, and look, you're my senior, in every respect, and you've set me a sterling example. There's no way I could do that. He never thought it. Why? Because spread before him from Bethel and Ai, up there on the ridge of the Judean hills, just down over the ridge, from where they could stand, where they stood, he could see over the ridge, brethren and sisters, and down it went, then a great sharp escarpment to the bottom of the floor, and then shore was absolutely beautiful. It was glorious. And the strife led to the next thing, and to the next thing, and to the next thing, and down, down, and down went Lot. And once you're on the down, brothers and sisters, it's awful hard to stop. Look at the steps. Verse 7, strife. Verse 10, he lifted up his eyes. Verse 11, Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan. Verse 12, he pitched his tent towards Sodom. Chapter 14 and verse 12, he dwelt in Sodom. And chapter 19 and verse 1, and there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. Totally assimilated, at least physically, with all the sociality of that place. So strife causes us to turn our back upon the man of faith. We lift up our eyes and we see marvelous things in this life. We choose them, or we won't rush in. We only pitch our tent towards Sodom. We don't go all the way at the start, but in the end we get there. And lo and behold, as time goes on, we are sitting right in the gate of that city. They are the steps, brothers and sisters, of Lot's decline, veiled. In whom the God of this world hath blinded, said the apostle, concerning those who were taken away with things like that. And what did he see? You know, the record is almost telling us what how Lot's mind was working. He lifted up his eyes, and we read in verse 10 of chapter 13, and he beheld all the plain of Jordan. All the plain of Jordan. You know, the word plain of Jordan, brethren and sisters, and it's used later on in another expression, means the circle of Jordan. Because you've got to remember this, that what Lot would have seen was vastly different what you would see today when you look down towards Sodom and Gomorrah. It looked nothing like it looks today. He would have seen a beautiful lake, because the top half of the Dead Sea, brethren and sisters, is very deep. And that little peninsula that sticks out divides the top half from the bottom half, and it's very deep at the top, but during the course of the summer, you could walk the entire width of the bottom part. And the geologists, of course, tell us that the character of the top and bottom are absolutely dissimilar, and the bottom part didn't exist. That's where Sodom and Gomorrah were. So all he could see was a very deep lake. And it was beautiful. The circle of Jordan, as the expression has it. You know, it was Jesus was there, wasn't he, later on with John the Baptist. And John the Baptist was down there, and it says they came from all the roundabout Jordan. From the circle of Jordan. To whom he addressed and said, say not to yourselves that you're Abraham's children. That would have had memories for them, wouldn't it? Because there was another one who looked down at the circle of Jordan. And he saw it down there, brethren and sisters, as something exceedingly beautiful. How did he see it? Well, he saw it in two ways. He first of all saw that it was well watered everywhere before Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, that is. And you see, it was like two things. It was like the garden of Yahweh, and it was like the land of Egypt. And do you know, brethren and sisters, that's right. Because you know the Nile Delta. Here comes the Nile from the hinterland of Africa, and it spreads out on the Delta, fans out in all its canals, and wherever it runs, of course, almost at ground level the canals are, there's fertility. Go to the land of Ur of the Chaldees, to the garden of Yahweh, the garden of Eden. There were four rivers. And as the great rivers the Tigris and the Euphrates came down and conjoined before the top of the Gulf, they fanned out in all these canals. So Egypt and the garden of Yahweh were very similar in lifestyle. They weren't two different things. He equated them. And at times, brethren and sisters, at times, we do see this life as if it were the kingdom of God. And though we might mouth platitudes, and saying we're all waiting for Christ's coming. It isn't a terrible world we live in. There are times when things go well, especially for some of us, go very well. When the garden of Yahweh is very much like the land of Egypt. And the land of Egypt is very much like the garden of Yahweh. If he'd have never been to Egypt, he would never have made that comparison. And neither would you. Or me. And therein lay his problem. It's not with accent that that's written like that, brothers and sisters. When he lifted up his eyes, that's how he saw it. And he made a decision between Bethel and Ai, and he chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east. There's something else about that Jordan that was interesting. You know, if you look at the Jordan Valley, you see an aerial picture of it. From the bottom of the Sea of Galilee till you come to the top of the Dead Sea is about a distance of 60 miles. I don't talk in kilometres, I was born a few years ago. 60 miles down there. But Jordan actually travels a torturous course which is about 240 miles long. Pretty obvious, brethren and sisters, something drastic happened to the terrain there, because it wouldn't have done that had there been such a drop as it is from 600 feet below at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee to nearly 1,400 feet below at Jordan, only 60 miles further. That river would have gone straight like that. But it didn't. So obviously there's been a tremendous upheaval there. And it left that river in that torturous course. And although it looked beautiful from where Lot stood, when God blasted the bottom end of the Dead Sea and he stagnated that water, brethren and sisters, and it piled up all those chemicals and killed every living thing in them, and it built up back into the sludge into the river as it oft times did in the flood periods, but then Jordan still looked beautiful from the distance because the top of the bracken was glorious. Zechariah called it and Jeremiah called it the pride of Jordan. But both prophets warned about what was underneath that bracken. And beneath that green top, which you see from the Judean hills or from the hills of Moab, brothers and sisters, there is a black, slimy, oomy mud, which stinks with rotting vegetation and is a breeding place for scorpions and snakes. And Jeremiah said, though they weary thee in the land of peace, what will you do in the pride of Jordan? Don't go near that. And what looked beautiful to the eyes of Lot, brothers and sisters, wasn't so beautiful when he got down there. And Jordan, you know, in its best moments, before the Holocaust of Sodom and Gomorrah, was never considered to be anything beautiful. But throughout the record of God's word, turn up any page you like about the River Jordan, it is only seen as a barrier between the promised land and the land of death. It is only seen as a symbol of the flesh, which runs from the living sea of Galilee through Adam, the city Adam, into the stagnation of death, where the Lord Jesus Christ came to step into the water to proclaim with John that all flesh is grass. That's what Jordan stood for, brethren and sisters, and Lot saw that as if it was the garden of Yahweh, because he thought it looked like Egypt. What a tragic mistake, brothers and sisters. It would have been better for Lot never to have seen Egypt. But he'd seen it and never forgot it. And in verse 12 we read this. And I'll read it with emphasis. Listen to it. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of Plain. Deliberate contrast there, brothers and sisters. One man stuck to the land, and the other man, he went and dwelt in a city. Now, I don't want anybody at the end of this study to uproot and all disperse into isolation, because the principle's not exactly like that today. But nonetheless, it was then. One dwelt in the land, and the other one dwelt in cities. You know, God's estimation, brothers and sisters, of the cities of mankind isn't hard to determine. In the law of Jubilee, for example, there were gradations of sale and resale as to what could be done and what couldn't be done. A long legal list about such transactions. One among which would said this: the land shall not be sold forever, for it's mine. But when the regulations came concerning cities, it could be sold and resold, but never the land. Isaiah 14, speaking of Babylon, when God, through the prophet, said that he was so destroyed Babylon that it would never rise again, he said, lest they fill the earth with their cities. So Babylon was destroyed, among other things, to stop the urbanization of society. That's why God destroyed him, lest he fill the world with his cities, said the prophet. Abraham dwelt in the land, and Lot dwelt in the cities. And there was the difference between the two men at that time. Lot, of course, didn't go straight to Sodom, brethren and sisters. He pitched his tent towards Sodom. You ever seen people do that? Of course you have. Any brother or sister that's ever exercised any responsibility in ecclesial life will inevitably come up with someone who pitches their tent towards Sodom. They're going to embark on a career into avenues of life which is not altogether conducive to spirituality. Oh, but they won't go all the way. We'll only do this much. Or we may have young people who have tremendous sporting abilities, who excel in these things at school to the great overweening pride of their parents, who cheer them on to victory. But let me go a certain way. When it comes to organized sport, no one. Many, of course, abide by that. Some don't. But whatever our children or ourselves do, brethren and sisters, that's going to go in any direction, that's going to take us into juxtaposition of wicked sinners exceedingly, but then don't go any other way. How many people say, oh yes, but I won't do this. I don't intend to do all that. I don't intend to do this. And I really haven't got any intent. Neither did Lot have any intention. He pitched his tent. Tent, brethren and sisters. He still was a pilgrim. He'd still made a decision to stay with Abraham in that sense. But his pilgrimage was going towards Sodom. Until in the end, he's got a home. And there he is sitting at that gate. And as I've made the suggestion, and it's only a suggestion because I couldn't prove a word of it, there's no mention of Lot's wife ever until you come to Sodom. And one wonders where he got her. Wherever he got her from, brothers and sisters, there's no question as to where her heart was born. And so Lot becomes very much settled, doesn't he? And isn't it a tragic thing when you read that verse in that word in verse 13, But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before Yahweh exceedingly. And you know, brothers and sisters, there are many fine things in life that we can do, which in themselves are excluded from our pilgrimage, not because of the things themselves necessarily, but of the associations into which we will be taken. Let's go back again to that illustration. Organized sport. What's wrong with organized sport? I love to see kids playing sport. I hate to see kids sitting around hanging on to each other. I like to see youngsters up and active. I think that's grand. And I think one of the things that is missing today from our youth is that vigorous thing which needs young people to exercise their lungs. I think it's great, brothers and sisters. But I remember the time when I was lined up before I came into the truth, but knew it, with only about 25 other men selected to remain with the last 30 after they'd pruned all the rest out of the hundreds that had come to the training, that I might stay on the training list of one of the league football teams. And I remember the coach grabbing me by the jumper in the middle of the oval when he gave us all an exhortation. Individually, he took each man by the jumper and brought him up to his face. And in his fanatical way, he told us all what was expected of us to that football club. Body, soul and spirit we had to give. And coming to me, why on earth he would ever select these words, I will not know. But he grabbed me by the chest, dragged me up and said, as for you, he said, this will be your religion. I'll never, ever forget that as long as I live. I knew the truth when he said that, brethren and sisters. And that's where it's wrong. The game itself, great for your limbs and lungs, but they were wicked sinners exceedingly, who bought you body, soul and spirit dedicated to a bag of wind. Your religion, that's what's wrong with it, but they were wicked sinners exceedingly. And we know what Ezekiel says about the sin of Sodom, brethren and sisters, don't we? Pride. Fullness of bread, abundance of idleness. They were haughty and committed abomination. You would think that that would be the comments upon the daily papers of our generation, wouldn't you, brethren and sisters? Arrogant pride, thundering good economy. For your information, we're going through a recession. I don't know who would ever know it. Thundering good economy, abundance of idleness in Australia, the greatest country on the earth. 4 weeks annual leave with loading, long service leave, public holidays, paid days off, flexi time. Goodness gracious me, no country in the world like that, brethren and sisters. Abundance of idleness. And are we haughty? They dragged the whole football club up an aeroplane, didn't they? Because they thought they had a divine right to wreck it. That's the Aussie. We live here. The wicked sinners exceedingly. And do we commit abomination? In the particular abomination spoken of here, brethren and sisters, which we hesitate to name, they tell us, according to the experts, that Sydney runs second only to San Francisco. This is where we live, here. What manner of people ought we to be? didn't have to make Lot's choice, brothers and sisters. We got born into this situation. God doesn't hold that against us. What a challenge it is to us that in the midst of this crooked and perverse generation, we should live out the principle of a tent existence, giving others the choice of this foul society and having nothing whatever to do with it ourselves. That's the principle we learn from Lot. And don't start the downward trend, strife. And when that comes, when there's strife between brethren and sisters, that's the end. And if ever there was a time when the brethren of Christ, the Christadelphians, ought to pull together, now it's that time, brethren and sisters, because we've got the Canaanite and the Perizzite in the land. And we ought to know better that none of us can exist on our own, and we need each other to walk with faith, with faithful Abraham. But now Lot is gone. Verse 14. And I want you to note how this is put. And Yahweh said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him. See how that's written? It doesn't say that Yahweh said unto Abraham after Lot had asked, or rather after Abraham had asked Lot to go. God holds that man responsible for that separation, brethren and sisters. Because I don't think anyone could ever believe